This is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Attention Please.
Could I have your attention, please?
I'm your host this week, Jim Burke, and I'm speaking please? This week with Gary Nelson, who, along with Doug Rogers, is leading an online webinar at the Jefferson County Public Library called Powering Our Future, Energy Independence for the North Olympic Peninsula. I also spoke with Liz Revord this past week. I'm talking with Liz Revord, the director of the Housing Solutions Network, and we're here to talk about housing and upcoming forums that are going to be happening right here on KPTZ. Hello, Liz. How are you today?
Hey, Jim. Good. Good. It's beautiful outside, so I will take any of the sunshine that I can get right now.
I know. We've gotten like 2 or 3 days out of the last 6 that have been rather pleasant. So tell me about yourself and how you came to be the director of Housing Solutions Network. Tell me about Housing Solutions Network. Why did it form? How did it form?
You're starting off with some loaded questions there, Jim. So let me just start with HSN. So Housing Solutions Network was formed as a brainchild in 2017 and took fruition in 2018 after the Jefferson County declared a housing crisis. This stemmed out of the Jefferson Community Foundation, but really was part of a community collaborative. So back in late 2017, early 2018, Jefferson Community Foundation convened their network of people, and that's what they do, to help identify some of the barriers to affordable housing and why we've just identified ourselves in a housing crisis. HSN is a convener of people and resources. So what we do is convene people who have passions and interests and desire to provide community-based solutions to the housing crisis in Jefferson County and in Port Townsend with resources. And if those resources weren't already created, then we've tried to create them. And so We are a network. So if you think of us as a spider web of individuals and agencies and institutions and passions and interest and energy, it really does kind of paint the picture of all the places that we have a touch or a reach to and in this community, which I think is a really beautiful picture to paint, especially in these spring days when you get a little bit of that do on the spider web. It really shows how big the spider web, how big it is.
So you're creating a web, a organization, a web.
A network. Yeah, that's what we are.
You're the Housing Solutions Network.
Yeah.
It's right there in your name.
Right?
Okay.
And we're a spider web of change makers, right? So we're housing advocates who might not have come into the picture as thinking of themselves as advocates, but they're really passionate people who want to see change in this community and have gotten on the soapbox before, so I know many people have heard it. But my husband and I moved to this community in 2018 for his job at the county. And so we moved into this community, and we had to sit in a cabin for a week before the rental house became available through his network at work. And so we moved into that home, and I started meeting new people and, you know, developing friends and relationships. And I found myself asking a lot of people what their housing looked like. And it was just an interest of mine, and there was no, you know, reason for it. But I found that a lot more of my friends were in untraditional housing situations where my husband and I actually lived in a single family home in Ludlow. Well, fast forward to January of 2021, and our landlord had asked us to vacate our property because they were going to take advantage of the housing market.
Things
had changed within their family dynamics. And so we were left wondering, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? We found a really wonderful rental in Uptown with some really fantastic landlords, but our rent is $800 more a month than what it was in Ludlow.
Sure.
And the opportunity for us to buy has kind of been pushed back. We've put less than 10 offers in on homes. In the last house we put an offer in on, it sold for $75,000 over asking, all cash and no protections. And that's not a place that we could...
No contingencies or inspections or anything. Yeah.
And so that's not, you know, when we think that we have skin in the game and then we find out that on the back end, like, we were never in that, right? Like, we never had an opportunity. And so I come to HSN out of frustration, but it's turned into more than that. I never thought of myself as a housing advocate, but here I am in the midst of it. And it's personally affected me. It's affected my family. my friends, my community. And so how do we make change?
That's a good question. I read something on local social media yesterday from a man who's quite respected in the community. It was on Nextdoor. And he was talking about the fact that so many other cities and so many other towns have created infill housing, and they've created, you know, ADUs, and then they've done things like given like special parking privileges to people who have ADUs, you know, a special parking space on the street in their city because, you know, they've created an ADU and they've created extra housing for the community. But then the people who have created the ADUs are not necessarily renting them out. They're not necessarily doing anything with them that's helping the community. They're simply using them as like vacation rentals for people who come in from out of town, or as a guest house, or maybe they're using it for a studio to make music or whatever. Those are all great things. But the point of the whole thing that he had written, we could fall prey again to this notion that if the city says, oh, we need infill housing, we need to do this, and we need incentives and so on and so forth, that people can use those incentives and create infill housing and ADUs and so on, and then not actually provide extra housing for the community. So how do you fight something like that? How do you work around or work through with the city and the county to create housing that people will actually use, that people will actually be able to afford?
Well, again, these are such loaded questions.
I know. Right?
I can tell you right now that we need to change our language around housing. So what you are talking about and what we experience here in Jefferson County is not just an inventory question, not a numbers question, mm-hmm. but access to that inventory. Right, and so when we look at 18,500 units across Jefferson County of housing units, 3,300 of those sit vacant. Now, vacant has an asterisk next to it. It could mean a second home, vacation rentals, Airbnbs. It could be that the mom has passed and the kids don't know what to do with the house. Mm-hmm. It could just be investment properties, hands down.
Right.
And so how do we open access? Because 3,300 units being put online would make a huge impact on this community. It's not just inventory by numbers, but it's inventory by access. And so what are the ways that we can protect housing for specifically, what HSN is looking at is our affordable workforce housing. So there's a large sector of the workforce, and what we're identifying as, you know, the section that we focus on is anywhere between 80 and 150% of the area median income. Now, again, language is really important, so let's all start with the basis of what I'm talking about. So these are working families who make up to $110,850 a year. Mm-hmm. So these aren't rich folks by any means, but it's people who are working in the vital service sectors of our community.
Working professionals.
Right. It's our nurses, our teachers. Right. It's our, you know, it's our nonprofit professionals like myself and my husband who works for the county.
Right.
It's my staff who, you know, works in nonprofit, and, you know, my staff, Kelsey, her husband works in the school system. And so it's people like us who we don't qualify for any housing subsidies because we make a little too much, but yet we don't make enough to purchase market rate housing. And so going back to your question, it's like, what are the things that we can implement that will help protect housing? Deed restrictions are something that we are still continuously learning about. Mm-hmm. If we look at other communities like Northern Michigan or even in Colorado, we see deed restrictions for working families that work at least 30 hours in their community. And so those homes are protected for those individuals. Mm-hmm. And you can still have mobility within your neighborhoods and your homes and the income that you bring in, but it isn't the same as the income of others in the community. And what I mean by that is area median income is really reflective of all people in our community. And it's not just working local wages. Mm-hmm. So we have, of course, an influx of retirees coming into our community,
right.
but we also have an influx of remote workers who have come into our community.
Right.
And so
thank you, COVID.
They're making Seattle wages. They're making San Francisco wages.
Right.
And the rest of us are making Jefferson County wages.
Right.
And that's not like a dig in particular on like who makes up our community, but it really does. These outside market pressures really affect who has what purchasing power here. And so if we look at it from that point of view, you know, what are the things that we can put in place now to help protect units of housing for a wider group of individuals who make up our local working economy?
Right. So it sounds like deed restrictions. It sounds also like the Jefferson Land Trust. What the Jefferson Land Trust does with farmland and forest land.
Yeah.
You're talking about deed restrictions for residential property.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the land trust would look at it as conservation. And right. aren't we doing that the same with homes? Aren't we having a conservation of homes right. for the local workforce? And so we could look at it like that. And again, language is so important. Right. So a lot more people would get on board if we talked about conservation as opposed to restrictions,
right?
So there's connotations within each one of those. One makes you feel really good about yourself. And the other one makes you think like, oh, there's more restrictions on my property.
So the other day when we actually did the first forum, which was what is a comprehensive affordable housing strategy and why mm-hmm. does Port Townsend need one mm-hmm. to air on Monday, March 13th. Look it up. One of the things I mentioned and that keeps coming up in conversations about housing is the idea that some people are being displaced around the country for various reasons. I mean, there's weather-related displacement or climate change, migration, or refugees. I mean, it's funny because refugees, you think of people who are like, they live on an island in the Pacific and their island is underwater. Mm-hmm. That's a different kind of refugee than somebody who's in California where they see their hillside burning. And then 2 months later, they see it sliding down into their living room because... Mm-hmm. There's no vegetation on the hill, and it's just turned into mm-hmm. a mudslide.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of climate refugee. And unfortunately, some of the people from California and other places around the Midwest and also in the South, where they're having tornadoes year-round now and things like that, they can't necessarily sell what they've got because they now have a distressed property that is in a flood zone, or they have a distressed property that's in a fire zone, or they have a distressed property. You get the idea.
Yeah.
But do they have flood insurance, earthquake insurance, you know?
Right,
forest,
right.
Is there such thing as forest fire or wildfire insurance? There should be.
I mean, there's probably a market for it now. But, right. you know, I think if we look at the case study within Paradise, California, I have a dear friend who's working on resilient communities and disaster response within those communities. And, right. and we're seeing that exact situation. People who, you know, were fleeing in the middle of a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back to find absolutely nothing remains.
Yeah.
And so what is it that they do? They rebuild a house on that property knowing that it's not going to get
in
covered
15
the second
or 20
time.
Years or it's or it's going to burn
or five.
Again. Or,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or that it's never going to be insurable.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, you know, I think that we are in a really wonderful geographic location
that is becoming quite desirable. Yes.
And
the more people come here, the more people want to come here.
The hidden gem that is here is really just no longer a hidden gem. And I think that that's part of the realization that we have to come to as a community. And so,
right.
you know, we can either say build it and they will come, or we can say we're not building it, but they're still coming.
Right.
So either we embrace this change and we plan for the change because that's what we need to do as a community
right.
to become more resilient, or we halt all development and we still have the influx. So I think it's right. better for us to be prepared and respond to and mitigate
right.
this impact than to, you know, say, no room, Port Townsend's closed.
Yeah.
You know, and well, somebody mentioned to me at yeah. one time that they felt like I was being a gatekeeper to the community when I'm trying to protect housing around those who earn up to 150% AMI. And I said, you know, again, language is important. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm trying to gatekeep. It's that I'm trying to make Port Townsend not have a revolving door, that every time somebody comes in, somebody else has to leave. And that's really important.
Right. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you're listening to Attention, Please.
So,
Liz, I wish we could talk all day, but we've already used twice as much time as I set aside for this interview, unfortunately. It's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming today.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking all the hard questions. And, you know, I just want to do a quick shout out and gratitude to the housing providers who are working to increase beyond the 80%, you know, of AMI, because mm-hmm. we're seeing a larger need for more affordable housing for a wider section of people. And I think that we'll continue to see change within this community and how we how we adapt and embrace it is up to us as a community. And so, you know, I think that as my mother always taught me when I was growing up, there's always more room at the table.
Very nice. That's a good thing to end on. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
This is Jim Burke, and this is Attention Please. I'm speaking today with Gary Nelson. Gary, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I'm representing a group of senior engineers, all retired, and we came together rather accidentally a few years ago and began teaching courses first through the adult learning program at the Unitarian Universalist Church in town, mm-hmm. and then through the library. We came to observe that maybe what we had to offer could be expanded to looking at energy independence and resilience for the North Olympic Peninsula. So that's how we got here.
Right. And so next Wednesday, you're starting a series which runs Wednesday, March 15th through April 19th.
Correct.
A collaboration with Clallam County Libraries, but it's at the Jefferson County Library, but it's virtual.
It's right? Virtual, yes.
Virtual.
Right.
And it's energy independence for the North Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah. Maybe that's a grandiose ambition.
Sounds like a laudable goal.
Yeah. The real emphasis, if one looks at it carefully, is that we are not very resilient out here mm-hmm. to if we're fed by a single transmission corridor that comes up from around Olympia and ends at a substation or a switching station down near Fat Smitty's at the end of...
Right, where 101 and 20 come together.
Yeah,
right. Down in Discovery Bay.
Yeah, right down near Discovery Bay. There's a big switching center down there where all these transmission lines come in, and they're fed out to Squim and onward to Port Angeles and, you know, all the way to the west. And then, of course, two of them go up, one to the paper mill and another feeds Jefferson County. If we were to lose those transmission lines for any reasons, and you can say, well, it hasn't happened yet, but we haven't had an earthquake yet.
But we did have quite a windstorm in November. Yes.
Well, that's an example of what you might call reliability rather than resilience, because we were still in good shape. Or was in isolated areas that didn't have electricity.
Some people didn't have power for 9 days, which is kind of extreme.
It was a hardship for a few people, relatively few.
Right.
Compared
I
to
had
the
power in 3 hours.
We were out for 19 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a hardship, and you know, you leave the refrigerator closed, and you know, so. Well, what happens if you're out for a week, or let's say a month, or if you talk to the emergency preparedness folks from both counties? They said, well, it could be a year, you know, before we got power back.
If there was catastrophic earthquake or a tsunami. Yeah.
Right, a number 9 earthquake with a tsunami, and you know, God knows what we might be facing, but we would be without power. Now, the possibility exists to exploit a newly emerging technology, not so new. It's been in the market for at least a decade, and it's called a microgrid. This technology is being deployed on commercial basis all over the world, really, but certainly here in the United States. It involves identifying a region that can be isolated from the main grid and can provide its own power. You might be a hospital, you might be a business park, you might be a data center, and some form of energy, reliable 24/7 energy is provided. Now, if we look below the covers, we discovered that almost all of these are fired by fuel cells, natural gas, reciprocating engine generators mm-hmm. or turbines,
right.
But they're all, they almost all have as their, what we call in the trade, firm energy, mm-hmm. energy that's there 24/7. It's almost all coming from natural gas at this point.
Right.
But
so a fossil fuel.
A fossil fuel, not exactly what we're looking for.
No.
But you say, well, wait a minute, can't you do it with solar panels? Sometimes. Right. But if your load is continuous, then you discover fairly quickly that you can It's difficult. Difficult to get there,
right,
even with batteries. There's two good sources, neither of which will pass a purchase order test at this point.
Okay.
Right? Both of these options will generate 24/7 carbon-free energy. The one that would be the least controversial would be geothermal. Mm-hmm. If you ask about geothermal for the North Olympic Peninsula, what we discover is that, well, we've actually explored that back as far as the 70s, and it doesn't look too good, that there's heat down there, but you have to drill a hole way too deep. Mm-hmm. There is a new technology that's being born, and a company over in Seattle called Altarock is prepared to drill the first-of-kind hole with a fancy new drill bit that uses radio waves to burn a hole through the rock, to melt a hole through the rock.
Wow.
And it comes from the plasma research labs at MIT. It doesn't require anything that you can't buy off the shelf. You can buy the radio equipment. This company, Quaise, is building a drill bit, and they've tested it in laboratory conditions, but not yet in geological conditions.
Right.
So there's a long way between the cup and the lip here, to admit. And we'll have a guest. The week three will come to us from Houston. It's all by Zoom, of course. Mm-hmm. But he comes to us from Houston with a background in the oil and gas drilling business, not the oil and gas business itself. Mm-hmm. They outsource all the drilling to independent companies.
Right.
And the big players in oil and gas drilling are solidly behind this new geothermal technology. So there's reason to be optimistic. Philip Ball is this fellow's name, and he looked over into a proprietary database using coordinates of different locations here on the peninsula. And he said, well, you know, maybe 7 kilometers. If you want to be conservative, let's say it's 10 kilometers. It's too deep to economically drill a hole. We can do it. I can't, but somebody can.
Somebody can.
Somebody can drill a hole 10 kilometers deep, but you can't afford it. But the claim is with this snazzy new drill bit that it melts a hole through the rock, and then a compressed air blows the dust, makes the liquefied rock into nanoparticles that are blown out as a dust stream. Okay,
wow.
Let's assume that works. The claim is that while drilling the hole, it leaves behind a glass lining, right? It melts the rock and leaves a glass lining, mm-hmm. which obviates a need for well casings. Well, 50 or 60% of the cost of drilling a hole is well casing.
Oh, wow.
So the second feature is that you don't have to pull the drill bit out every once in a while to put in a new one. So, you know, if you're a mile down, you've got to pull a lot of pipe out of the hole and mm-hmm. put a new drill bit and put it all back down, and then you can drill a little while. This is continuous drilling. So their claim is that they'll be able to cut the cost of drilling well beyond half. Now we're talking a possibility. So this new form of geothermal is affectionately called geothermal anywhere. We're anywhere.
Including the Olympic Peninsula.
Well, we will we'll find out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be overly optimistic.
Right.
But hopeful mm-hmm. that it could work. And if it does, it's a source of energy that would be ideal. Drill a hole, generate some energy. We could have little microgrids, one for Forks. We could have we could generate our own electricity for Port Angeles and Squim and so forth. So you can see where this would have some benefit. Mm-hmm. The second technology that's in the pipeline is called a micro nuclear reactor. Now, obviously, there'll be some people that go, oh, no. He's not going to talk about that. Well, right. You know, the closer you look at this technology, the more sense it makes. There aren't a lot of options mm-hmm. for continuous, clean, firm energy, or what you might call 24/7 carbon-free energy. Mm-hmm. So nuclear and geothermal are at the top of the list. So how about this? By 2035, we're resilient to loss of transmission lines,
mm-hmm.
the BPA transmission lines. And how would you do that? Well, how about generating our own electricity? How would you afford that?
So just a quick question about the nukes, because naturally a lot of people have a problem with those. But are we talking about like a small fission reactor, like a pebble reactor, that kind of a thing?
Well, yeah. The pebble reactor, the one that's closest to fruition is, what's it called? UltraSafe.
Mm-hmm.
UltraSafe nuclear company. They are envisioning their product as a nuclear battery. So they're envisioning deploying these things and installing them in a matter of weeks. This is a radical in the sense of our history.
Right, right.
But the idea is that these would not require a room full of operators and big screens and so forth.
Right.
They can be remotely operated. Both of these, the billiard balls or golf balls,
right.
and the UltraSafe, use this fuel that is a little bit of uranium and some... it's encapsulated in a material that won't melt.
Mm-hmm.
It has some carbon is in there. Anyway, these are made into little pebbles, into little capsules that cannot melt.
Right.
That no matter if you have an accident with the reactor, the fuel will not melt.
Mm-hmm.
It might get very hot,
okay.
but it won't burn its way through the center of
yeah,
the earth.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
There's no China syndrome here,
right.
so to speak.
Right. So just getting back to the overall idea, regardless of how the electricity is generated, how do the microgrids work in terms of giving us or giving a locality, resiliency and independence from the grid if necessary?
The idea is to install the equipment, a generating source, so that it can provide power to an isolated community.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say your community might be like Cape George would be an example. We could put a little reactor up there or some energy source and provide energy for all the folks in Cape George. It's already connected to the grid, but mm-hmm. you could have a switch that if you open the switch, then you're isolated, or the term islanded mm-hmm. is used. So islanded, and you're running your own grid, and you're self-sufficient. And when the grid is working, then that energy can be treated as surplus and sold. So the benefit would be a revenue stream on a continuous basis, and when necessary, you would invoke your resilience and you
disconnect
and everybody wins.
Yeah. Gary, we could talk for hours about this stuff. It's pretty fascinating, but we're out of time. So Wednesday, March 15th through April 19th. And what time of the day?
6:30 in the evening.
6:30 in the evening.
And if you're interested, you can go to jclibrary.info.
jclibrary.info.
And look for events and find this event that has to do with microgrids and energy independence for the North Olympic Peninsula and click on it and away you go.
So fantastic. You and anybody can join in?
Right. No registration required.
Fantastic.
And we'd certainly like to have everybody show.
All right. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
I think it's all quite fascinating. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Could I have your attention, please?
My thanks go out to Liz Rebord and Gary Nelson for agreeing to be interviewed for Attention Please this week. I'm your host, Jim Burke. Thanks for listening to Attention Please.